Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're right in the middle of audio open lines. Laid a couple issues on the table. Why is it that, at least at this point, those who are eyeing the White House in 2008 on the Republican side are unwilling to say overturn Roe, especially when there's a South Dakota law that, if it were accepted by the Supreme Court, would overturn Roe. Also, that Da Vinci trial continues to unfold. And I want to know from you, are you going to go see the movie when it comes out in May? It's audio open lines. One of the highlights of my summer, last summer, even though it meant a long stint of teaching in a very warm classroom with a group of teenagers. Does that sound great? It was. It was amazing. During last summer, going up to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and teaching at Christ Academy 2005. Well, they got Christ Academy 2006 coming up. It's a two-week residential program for high school-aged men. It won't make a pastor out of them, but we'll show them what seminary life, classroom, chapel is all about, and it may in the future be that seed that you can plant for that young man to study for the pastoral ministry. For more information about Christ Academy 2006, June the 18th through July the 1st, this summer, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, and ask about Christ Academy 2006. You can also find out more at our website, issuesetc.org. There on the homepage, scroll down, and you'll find information on Christ Academy 2006. Well, Domino's Pizza founder Daniel Monahan, is bankrolling. We talked about this last week. He's bankrolling this development called Ave Maria. It is both a Roman Catholic university and a surrounding town. It's a new town southwest of Florida. It's being built around this Catholic law school. Monahan wants the town to espouse a conservative Catholic value, which means no access to contraceptives or abortion procedures if he and the developers have their way about it. Here's a story from National Public Radio.
In southwest Florida over abortion, contraceptives, and a new town being built around a Catholic university. Tom Monahan, the founder of Domino's Pizza, is bankrolling the project. A devout Catholic, Monahan wants the community to exemplify his strict conservative values. Amy Tardiff of member station WGCU in Fort Myers has this report.
Tom Monahan is building a European-inspired dream on what were tomato fields east of Naples, Florida. A 100-foot-tall cathedral and what planners call the largest crucifix in the nation will greet people as they enter the new town of Ave Maria and the university of the same name. At last month's groundbreaking, Monahan spelled out his vision.
We were able to build a town that would be conducive to family living and a safe town and a wholesome town.
Ave Maria is the first Roman Catholic university to be built in the United States in 40 years. Florida Governor Jeb Bush stood by Monahan's side and touted plans for affordable housing and a walkable community.
These are the kinds of projects that we have really provided incentives for and encourage people to do. And so I think it'll be a model for sustainable living, not just for Florida, but for the country.
Others worry about Ave Maria and Monahan's definition of a wholesome town conducive to family living. He's personally footing most of the construction costs. He'll have oversight over the commercial real estate. And he's asking his developer partner to favor drugstores which agree not to carry contraceptives. Ave Maria project manager and developer Blake Gable says it's a request, not a requirement.
We haven't restricted the sale of contraceptives, but we've asked that the retailers, in deference to the university and what they're trying to accomplish, you know, consider refraining from selling contraceptives.
Contraceptives may also be an issue when the Naples Community Hospital builds a clinic in the town. It's been asked not to give contraceptives to students or make abortion referrals. The head of the local Planned Parenthood, Shar Wendell, says that's unfair.
The majority of Americans use birth control, and to make it difficult for people in that community to get birth control is putting an undue burden on people controlling their own reproductive health.
Wendell doesn't have to look beyond her office window to see what may be coming. Ave Maria students have protested, prayed, and handed out literature at her Planned Parenthood chapter, since a temporary university campus opened a year ago. On a recent Thursday night, a half dozen students kneeled on the sidewalk, clutched rosaries, and sang quietly. 18-year-old Brendan Ford of San Francisco led the group.
I think that the condoms are not helpful at all, and so any encouragement to using condoms, using any sort of contraception, is bad, and we shouldn't encourage that.
The American Civil Liberties Union is paying close attention to the developments at Ave Maria. The Florida director of the ACLU, Howard Simon, has been visiting Naples to set up a local chapter to monitor the situation. Simon says he fears Monahan may not stop with contraceptives.
I think it's rather naive to think that this first request that pharmacies not sell birth control pills will become the last request, and that these requests themselves will not turn into eventually legal requirements. And therein lies the problem.
Simon says religious organizations cannot exercise governmental power. But Ave Maria University President Nick Healy is trying to ease concerns. He says it may be Tom Monahan's vision to have a devout Catholic town with no pornography, no contraceptives, and no abortions. But this vision won't necessarily become a reality.
Tom Monahan speaks very candidly from the heart, and he often expresses his hopes and aspirations, which are not always something that can be accomplished when you're in a major real estate development with partners who have to be concerned about commercial realities and legal realities and so forth.
Ave Maria will be ready for residents to move in next spring, with the campus opening that fall. The first condominium units went up for sale last week. For NPR News, I'm Amy Tardiff in Fort Myers, Florida.
All right, it's Audio Open Lines, Issues, Etc. for about the next 10-15 minutes. I want to hear from you on this subject as well. Tom Monahan, former Domino's founder, has decided that Ave Maria not only makes a good university, but also a town. He continues to the rumor that he was building an all-Catholic town, an exclusively Catholic town, has been put to rest in the news media. That's good. But they're still concerned. The ACLU in particular seems a bit surprised that Roman Catholics are against contraception. Go figure. I mean, Roman Catholics against contraception. What will they think of next? Little bit surprised. I find it odd that the you may have heard it there, the rep for the ACLU there at the end of that piece said he doesn't think that the town that Tom Monahan is building is going to stop at simply requesting pharmacies not to sell contraceptives. Does anyone sense the irony that in the state of Illinois, the governor required that pharmacies sell abortifacients and that pharmacists lose their jobs in Illinois if they don't? Now, look, if it works one way, it works the other. If Tom Monahan wants to set up his own town and be governor for life or mayor for life in that town, he should at least have the same kind of prerogatives that Rod Blagojevich has in Illinois. Let's talk with you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. First, Steve calls from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Doing well.
Hey, you know what I find ironic about this whole Catholicville USA?
Yeah.
Well, it's monasticism with a new spin.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what's the monastic life? We're going to go separate ourselves off from the world. We'll be holy community. We won't have any sin. So how is that any different than what he's trying to do in a more limited sense?
I mean, he's doing it in a very limited sense. He's just talking about a commercial development around his real focus. At least the last interview I heard with Tom Monahan was his real focus is on the university, the law school, Ave Maria. And then, of course, He wants to see his development partners be able to spin off the commercial developments all around that. Interesting term you use, Catholicville, USA. But so monasticism in particularly an American way of doing monasticism.
Right.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting. And what happens is, and if you look at kind of the church history, whenever you have these little groups set up, and Protestants are just as guilty of this.
Jerry Falwell had down there near his university, Liberty.
Right.
He's doing exactly the same thing.
And what happens is they resort to the law to govern, because they don't have any faith in the gospel.
Interesting thought, Steve. Interesting thought. Thank you for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Charles calls from St. Louis. Charles, welcome.
Thank you very much. I wanted to go back to Roe versus Wade.
Okay.
And George Allen not directly answering the question. I think at least in part because he wanted more to explain what Roe versus Wade allows and doesn't allow. So I can understand to some extent preferring a longer rather than a shorter yes-no answer.
Do you agree, Charles, that sooner or later the prospective candidates for the Republican presidential seat are going to have to answer that question, especially given the fact that the South Dakota law has made it the question of the day? If you want to be president, do you think it's fair for guys like Tim Russert to say and to press them on the question, will you say overturn Roe?
Yes, I think it's fair. Could I just offer another alternative position?
Oh, yeah.
There's a fellow named David C. Reardon, who is the founder of the Elliott Institute in Springfield, Illinois, although he now lives in St. Charles, Missouri, who has been – he's very strong in the post-abortion syndrome movement in publicizing the deleterious effects of abortion. And he made the observation that Roe versus Wade is viewed as being a woman's right to an abortion, but technically and legally, it's a medical procedure. And indeed, Roe itself states that abuses will be regulated by civil law and by peer pressure. And he believes that abortions could be almost eliminated if laws could be changed to really implement informed consent, and if the time could be extended beyond 7 years, because it usually takes at least 5 to 10 years before women really come to terms with their circumstances.
The time for what extended beyond 7 years?
I'm trying to think of what's that law, statute of limitations.
Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying.
If the statute of limitations could be extended, and in fact he introduced a bill in South Dakota to try to define what would constitute informed consent in the abortion issue. And it was defeated.
Interesting.
and it was defeated. He even explains it. He says because of the 22 people, of the 22 legislators who voted against the bill that outlawed most abortions, 7 of those people were on the committee that considered his bill.
All right. Charles, thank you for the call. We've had David Reardon as a guest several times on the program, and we've been talking more and more about this. In fact, Scott Klusendorf was the last one to bring it up last week on the program, where he says we really need to focus our energies, our efforts, and our money, and that was one of the things Scott was talking about, on not trying to fight a battle that we were likely to lose in the Supreme Court, and at the same time, if we lose paying the legal bills of the other side, but using our money to open that door that Reardon has so rightly said exists in Roe to regulate abuses and to regulate Roe. Everyone wants to see it overturned, but as Klusendorf pointed out on the show last week, we don't have the votes yet. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. Audio open lines. Charles, I'm glad you point that out. I'm glad that you do see it as a fair question to ask of presidential candidates and candidates who will be running as pro-choice candidates. What do you say about Roe? Hey, if we can ask the Supreme Court justices when they're sitting, or the prospective Supreme Court justices, we really, really should be asking the presidents or the prospective presidents. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We've got several issues on the table during open lines. First of all, do you find it odd that pro-life candidates or men who'd like to be candidates for president in 2008 have a hard time saying overturn Roe? Will you be watching the Da Vinci movie, especially now that so much publicity has been given to its release with the Da Vinci Code trial in London? What do you think about the several faces of Islam? I say the question is, what's the real Islam? don't paint all Muslims with the same brush. If they're peace-loving Muslims, good. Commend them for being peace-loving. But let's not forget that the real question is, what is Islam? Which is the real Islam? The peace-loving Western kind or the militant kind that we find in the majority of Islamic states? What do you think about the so-called, one of our callers called it Catholicville, USA, that Tom Monahan, Domino's founder, has decided he's going to build in Florida? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Coming to you live, this is the 13th day of March. It's Monday. Jane's up next. She calls from St. Louis. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Don. I can say, first I want to comment about the Da Vinci, but if Mr. Monahan wants to do what he wants for the $1 million, just let him do it. It's his place or whatever. But what I want to talk about truly, seriously, Da Vinci Code. I will not read the book. I will not look at the movie. There's a simple phrase, garbage in, garbage out. I will not look at that stuff. Secondly, I think that every time I hear about it, it is actually an insult against Mary Magdalene, in addition to my Lord Jesus Christ. But it is, I'm a woman, you know, but it's an insult against Jesus, but it's also an insult against Mary Magdalene. Men and women are capable of having friendships. Secondly, I think a lot of this stuff on TV or movies or books are written by, like, married men. And maybe they don't understand that there could be a pure love.
Okay.
What do you think?
All right. I understand what you're saying there. Now, this gets to one of the contentions, and thank you very much, Jane. This gets to one of the contentions of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. It can get lost in the shuffle, but the basic contention is that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, husband and wife. They had children, and that those children still exist. Not those children, but those children's children, children, children. The descendants still exist. And that there has been a concerted and conscious effort on the part of the church from the very beginning to cover up all those facts, those alleged facts. And Jane, you point out something that's quite interesting. Many have said, well, the premise of Dan Brown's novel is so liberating for women that a woman has a significant role to play in the real history of Christianity. But the premise of Dan Brown's novel is that Jesus and Mary Magdalene could not possibly have had the relationship that Scripture describes they had, which is master and disciple, savior and sinner. No, there had to be something more to it. In fact, Dan Brown, in interviews when asked, well, the Bible doesn't say anything whatsoever to even intimate that they were intimate. And Dan Brown says, well, there's your evidence. That's the sign that they covered it up. No evidence constitutes evidence because it's evidence of a cover-up. Really, he says the very fact that the Bible never even hints at a relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene for him is evidence that one existed. And then he says, well, you know, men of that time, it would have been scandalous for a man of that time not to have been married at Jesus' age. Well, an awful lot of things Jesus did that was scandalous. The first of which was going to the cross to suffer for us, including Dan Brown. So what about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. LCMS World Relief is keeping its eye on what's going on in the world, whether it's the Sudan, the aftermath of hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis. All of those things are still on the plate at LCMS World Relief. It's Christ-centered, cross-focused relief. They take your relief dollars and they connect them to congregations where Christ crucified for sinners is preached, right there where the people need both your relief and that message. To find out more about LCMS World Relief, go to our website, look for their logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call and donate their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Well, here's where I come down, at least at this point. You know, all opinions must remain provisional this far out from a presidential election. But sooner or later, the Republican candidate very likely will be pro-life. If it's Bill Frist, let's say Bill Frist got the major numbers, he's pro-life. Mitt Romney now says he's pro-life. Number three, Senator Allen says he's pro-life. sooner or later they will have to just come out and plainly answer the question, yes, I want to see Roe overturned. Why might they not be doing that? Well, I've mentioned it already, we don't have the votes. Maybe as a matter of expediency, they're saying, look, as long as we don't have the votes and as long as it's not really a possibility, why even talk about it? Now, if we do have the votes, whoever wants to sit in the White House had better be willing to answer that question. Because that goes to what he intends to do when there's an opening on the Supreme Court. And by hook or crook, we've been faced with this dilemma. South Dakota will not be the last state to make this attempt, and it will not be the last time this question is raised. Joining us here in Studio A, Dr. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest. He's an international journalist and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Center, the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. He joins us to talk about letters to the editor. Do you read these things? I do. In fact, they're probably number three on my list of things to read when I open up the paper. First, there's the headlines, then there's the editorials, and then there's the letters to the editor. You learn an awful lot about your fellow citizens by reading those letters. So how do those get published? Not every letter that comes into the office gets published. What is an editor looking for? What is a newspaper looking for when they publish a letter to the editor? Uwe Simonetto, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be back.
What if there's one thing, before we go to this break, one thing with only a minute that an editor is looking for when he picks up a letter that comes in and he says, let's put this in the next edition. What is that thing?
It's crisp, short, and to the point.
Brevity, the soul of
brevity, brevity, clarity, and, you know, from a journalistic point of view, make it clear in the first sentence already what you're trying to say and what you're addressing here.
Is it true that you kind of know the whole journalistic scene?
Right.
Is it true, especially print journalism, that editorial boards are inclined against printing letters that disagree with their positions?
Well, this is not generally true. It certainly is true among certain newspapers, and it's rather unpleasant. We will discuss this later on because I was sitting in that chair, and I was at one point in charge of what was published and what was not. And what I used to do in order to encourage people to write crisp and clear and short letters to the editor was to write letters to the editor to my own articles, responding to my own articles in a negative way, in a positive way, attacking me, applauding me, taking the mickey out of me, all these things, especially when you start a new... Of course, you know, I had to find other names for that and strange towns. I had to go through telephone directories whether these persons existed or not. But, yes.
Let's talk about that more on the other side of the break.
It's funny.
Little-known fact about Uwe Simonetto, after he publishes a column or a piece, he may be one of those writing a letter to the editor responding to himself. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
St. Paul says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain, and we of all men are most to be pitied. There is no more important truth than the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ for us sinners. And it's never too early to begin teaching your children and grandchildren that truth. He is Risen Indeed is the name of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March. It's a children's book that tells the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. Find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order He is Risen Indeed for your child or your grandchild, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. He is Risen Indeed is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Racial issues, common problem, common solution.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the powerful anti-racism book, One Blood. Well, Ken, many people have tried, unsuccessfully, to solve the problem of racism. Are you saying that we all share the same problem, but we do have the same solution?
Well, Mark, many people, including celebrities, think they have the answer to racial issues. Recently, Morgan Freeman, the famous African-American actor, was asked about this on American television. He suggested that Americans simply stop talking about whites and blacks. He said that by stressing differences between certain people groups, it actually hinders, not helps, relations. In one sense, he's right. We shouldn't highlight differences, since the Bible teaches that all people are of one blood. But not talking about it will definitely not solve the problem. To begin to find answers, we need to turn to the Bible, where we'll find that all people share not only a common problem, but a common solution. Perhaps no one says it better than Dr. Charles Ware, a frequent speaker on racial reconciliation at many of our conferences. He says, quote, "We have a common father named Adam, we've got a common problem named sin, and we've got a common solution, his name is Jesus Christ." Unless our Western cultures turn back to the Bible for answers, we'll remain divided by sin instead of being reunited by Jesus Christ and solve racial issues.
What does sin have to do with death and suffering? That connection is explored by Ken Ham in his free booklet, Why Is There Death and Suffering? It's free at AnswersRadio.com.
Dr. Carl Fakencher on the Center of Seminary Life at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Certainly, we would begin by expressing our strong commitment to the Scriptures and the Lutheran Confessions. Everything that we do here is gathered around God's Word, whether that is a matter of our daily worship in the chapel or the prayer life that is a part of our activity together. The classes themselves are always focused on proclaiming Christ as well. I think another very important aspect of our seminary that makes us unique is the relationship between the faculty and the students. And of course, always it's based on our shared faith in Christ Jesus.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, or to schedule an on-campus visit, call 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155.
There are over 3,000 children in the St. Louis area who need quality foster parenting and stable homes. Homes free of violence, abuse, and neglect. Homes complete with consistency, caring, and strength. Foster families can provide the building blocks necessary to establish positive patterns of behavior in children. Urban Behavioral Health Care Institute is looking for caring individuals interested in serving as a link to permanent family living. Contact UBH for more information.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., Dr. Mike Middendorf of Concordia University in Irvine, California, on The Word of God. We'll also review John Hagee's sermon yesterday on the marriage covenant. That should be interesting. We haven't done a Hagee sermon in quite some time. And Issues, Etc. sermon review coming up tomorrow on the program. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He joins us here in the last half hour to talk about how to write a letter to the editor, not just to write it or put a stamp on it or get it sent, but how to get it printed as well. He's an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. If you got a question or a comment for Uwe, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, before the break, you were telling us that when you sat in the editor's seat at some time during your career, you made a practice of often writing letters to the editor. Tell us about that.
Yes.
Why was that?
Well, that was specifically when I started a new publication, or when I revamped a publication and, you know, redesigned it. And then, of course, you needed a lot of input. Now, the theory is, or it's a practice in every editor, everybody who's ever been in the editor's chair, editor-in-chief's chair, managing editor's chair, will tell you that letters to the editor tend to be a nightmare because most people don't know how to write an letter to the editor. Most people don't know how to write in the first place. And those who have very firm opinions express them usually very unfirmly. So this is very sloppy. So in order to get really crisp, good, as we would say in very untheological journalese, sexy letters to the editor, and to encourage people to write like that. So when I started a magazine, a new magazine, or a revamped, 2 issues later, I would start off with a bunch of letters to the editor, all of which I had written myself or colleagues of mine, not applauding my own copy, but very often attacking me rather viciously, with a lot of tongue-in-cheek, and sometimes praising me, sometimes calling me a fool, but anything to simply encourage people to really have the guts to sit down and write properly. I know you might find this unethical, but it is a wonderful tool to encourage people to write good letters to the editor. And once I've done that for a couple of times, couple of issues, 2-3 issues, I found that it worked exceedingly well, because then you have enough imitators who said, ah, this is how I write a letter to the editor. And then you get some really good, juicy stuff out of people.
What? Just kind of an aside here, Uwe, what would it tell you as a managing editor, or if you weren't getting letters to the editor, even after the publication was underway, what does that tell you about your own publication if you're not getting the readers to respond in that way?
Well, I think it wouldn't tell me anything in particular, because as I said, the readers might be good, diligent readers of the publication and might like it, but they're simply not trained to respond to it properly. And therefore, you have to take them by the hands and say, look, this is how you do it. But you can't say, hey, I'm the editor, I'm now writing against me, so why don't you do it like that?
Is that common practice in print journalism?
Well, I don't know how much it is on this side of the Atlantic. It certainly isn't Germany, where I come from, and other parts of the world. And, you know, all across the spectrum, I mean, really first-rate editors-in-chief and managing editors have done so, and media consultants have done so in Germany, but I'm quite sure it happens here too. It wouldn't happen in something like St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I don't believe, but it probably would happen in a specialized, a good highbrow magazine, a lively magazine, yes.
Are the editors in print journalism, are they looking for response? Do they want to be reading letters to the editor?
Oh, absolutely. They would. They love to. A good journalist. We're talking about good ones here. A good professional journalist obviously doesn't want to write into a void. A good professional journalist wants to get reaction, wants to hear and see what's going on. And once the response is crisp, even if it's negative, that's not the problem, because we are adult enough to cope with that. But if it's good and crisp and makes sense, and if, God willing, it is funny or amusing, then so much the better.
I think you mentioned the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It has a reputation, deserved or undeserved, in this area, and even nationally, actually, for being one of the more liberal, especially one of the more liberal Midwestern papers in its editorial board. I don't know if it's deserved or undeserved. We use it quite a bit in terms of just basic information on the program. But someone says, listening to us now, look, I can't write to the Post-Dispatch and letter to the editor, because they're not going to publish it, because I'm going to disagree with them, and their editorial board is so monolithically liberal. They would never publish what I write because I disagree with their positions on so many things. Is that true?
Well, I have never tried it, and I'm not a political liberal, at least not in the American sense of the word. I've never tried it, but it strikes me to be rather monolithically knee-jerk liberal, really. It's not very... not very exciting. Because
does that mean they wouldn't be publishing opposing letters to the editor?
I suspect that if they have a bright moment in the morning before they get tired of everything, they will appreciate a negative but well-written and well-argued letter, too. I mean, otherwise, I would be condemning colleagues over there down the Grove. They can't be that daft. But it is true that I haven't seen too many opposing letters to the editor there. But this may well be true, Todd, be the case, because so few conservatives know how to write well. Yes, the top level, you know, the National Review. There you get some pretty good stuff. Wall Street Journal. There you get probably the crispest and funniest thing. There's this marvelous saying, you know, the only conservatives have fun. But usually people pushing their own conservative or right-wing causes, and then you know, we have to make a difference here as well, do so dully that, you know, I wouldn't be able to print them either.
Let's talk about some of the basics, beginning with the fact that most newspapers and many print magazines and journals have a required format.
Right.
That when you send in a letter, this is how they want it sent in.
So all you have to do is pick up a newspaper, pick up the newspaper you are writing to, and see how they run the letters to the editor. And it starts off in, and then you give the title of, and the date of the article you're responding to, and then off you go. Another thing is very good, if you are so inclined, give your contribution a very good, crisp headline, so that they go, oh, this is something that I would like to put into my paper. And then respond very, very briefly, and very crisply. Go straight into the matter. Go attack straight what you want to discuss. Say, Mr. Tiddly Push made this observation, and then explain that why you disagree, and do so without very many words. I mean, somebody has written here, keep it to 150, 200 words. That's already plenty. Very crisp, and don't make it an overall condemnation of the article, because then you make yourself, you know, then set yourself up for ridicule. You want to take one point that you disagree with out of the that article and argue against the point that the author is making, and argue it well, if you can, with a bit of a sense of humor. If you don't know how to use hyperbole, avoid it, and then the chances are that you might get printed. There's no guarantee of it, of course.
You mentioned both hyperbole and a sense of humor. What are the dangers there in either exaggerating a point or understating a point?
Well, overstating the point, obviously, in a hyperbole, would mean being over the top, being insulting, being objectionable, using bad language, calling somebody an idiot, even if he is one. You don't put this in print, you know, that sort of thing. Understating hyperbole, well, if your sense of humor is so bone dry that an English nobleman can't get it, you know, then forget about it. Then don't do it. Then try to juice it up a little bit. So you really have to know, master the English language. And since these are short contributions, and since you put so much, you find it so important to have this published, then work on it, and work on it very carefully, unless you are, of course, a professional writer and you have experience in this.
It strikes me a couple other basics might be that it does have to be timely. I mean, if you read something in the newspaper on Monday and you don't write your letter to the editor until Friday, the chances of it getting published are pretty slim.
Well, you might as well, you might be better off writing a love letter to your wife. I mean, that's would probably be much more appreciated. Certainly the editor, you have to sit down and write, if it's for a daily. You have to sit down and write within 24 hours and have it in maximum within 48 hours, and that's already late.
You have talked about how kind of the general citizens would respond through letters to the editor. What about pastors? Often when they write letters to the editor, It will get published with the Reverend so-and-so underneath
right.
that. And that does kind of send it into a different caliber
right.
For the readers very often. So you mentioned off the air that pastors are usually not the best writers when it comes to these things.
Yeah, especially not the best writers for texts like that. To begin with, pastors are people who use the spoken word first and foremost. So, you know, that is a totally different approach. So if you are lucky enough as a pastor to be good a good writer as well as a good speaker, so much the better. Second thing is a pastor is very inclined, very often at least, to be convinced that he is the bearer of truth and nothing but the truth. And how dare you question his truthfulness? Well, if that comes across, and it very often does, the self-righteousness. And then they never find an end. I mean, they're sort of like Thomas Mann, no period in the first chapter of the article. Well, that is also very bad. There should be, and I hope one day I'll be offering courses, writing courses, journalistic writing courses for clergy, because pastors have to put themselves into the mindset, in this particular case, not of the congregation in the pews down there, but the mindset of an editor who is very, you know, he's under tremendous pressure. He has a page to fill. He has tons and tons and tons of copy to sift through. And then suddenly here is the Reverend Schaefer from somewhere, and he has something important to say, and he's full of himself, and he's all blustery. But in the end, you don't know what he's trying to say, and the whole thing runs 1,000 words. You know, it doesn't work. And then the guy is upset that he doesn't get published, and he hasn't even bothered to see the realities of a daily newspaper or a weekly magazine or whatever we're dealing with here.
Well, I know that sitting in this chair has given me a bit of perspective on that, because we get a lot of response via email and sometimes through the mail as well to what we say here on this program. The program does function in many ways as an editorial page.
Right.
And so people will respond. And when I get a letter, for instance, that is single-spaced, very long paragraphs and almost out to the margins of the page, I'm far less likely to dig into it, given my limited time,
right.
than one that simply states its case in about one or two paragraphs, and then whether or not it agrees or disagrees with the program.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, actually, you see, I think people sending you a long stream of consciousness are incredibly rude. They are—it's an imposition. You know, they're imposing. They actually expect of you to waste your time, to sacrifice your time, which is limited anyway. To A, study this, then it's badly written, then it is single-space type, then there are long paragraphs. As you, all these things you mentioned are absolutely perfect example of something that makes one very angry if you're sitting in an editor's chair. And then at the end is, you know, is the Right Reverend something, you know, Christ Episcopal Church somewhere. No, it doesn't work like that. And you should actually send it, this is another thing, and good editors, if they have the time, and if the person is important enough or seems important enough, you should just put a sticker on it, a yellow sticker, and say, please cut it down to 100 words. Thank you.
Send it back.
Send it back. And I might consider it. But it is true that we have the church. That's another issue for another day. But pastors have a problem with the media. That are not all media, it's not all media made, but it's very often also church made, because simply they don't understand what the constrictions and the pressures of media personnel, and it's very sad.
Folks, if you have any experience in writing a letter to the editor, I'd like to hear from you. We've got about 10 minutes left in our conversation and in the program today with Dr. Uwe Simonetto on how to write a letter to the editor and get it published. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe is an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe, we deal with callers on this program. And we have, you wouldn't think we would, but Jeff and I have long conversations about what makes good callers, especially if we've had one during the day. We will actually go back into the office after the program is over, and we will talk with each other about that caller. And sometimes, if we have enough time, we will take the call apart and say what made it good. The very same kind of a thing that we do with guests when we do a postmortem on a show. What made that good? What needed improvement? I imagine that editors are probably going through the same thing, although their time is probably much, much more precious, to say, here's a letter to the editor, showing it to the colleague and say, now that person wrote a good letter.
Right. And then actually, if I were teaching a journalism class, then I would say if the letter, even if it's against you, is so good, you're obligated to print it. Because if you find it readable, then definitely your readers will find it readable. And this gets me back to my major theme here at St. Louis. It is the calling, of course, of a journalist to provide the reader with good readable materials. So you're very right. And there are occasionally letters to the editor. See, I've worked for monthlies, quarterlies, but also dailies. And it really depends. I mean, on a daily newspaper, we used to say in Germany right after the war, the one great thing about the daily newspaper is the next morning it hangs in the outhouse, you know, on a hook. That wasn't the days when we had outhouses. But that is, of course, not the magazine, would be highly impractical. But it is magazine editors or editors of quarterlies, and when you can write longer pieces, very much consider these texts and discuss them, and occasionally when they're good enough but not well enough written, actually bother to write back to that person, say, please come back, this is you have some wonderful ideas, but please express them so that we can actually reproduce them.
We've talked a bit about this in terms of kind of the local outlets, but what about someone who says, look, I read something in the New York Times or the Washington Post or in the Los Angeles Times, these papers of record, whether they deserve the title or not, but the big papers, the ones that get delivered to doorsteps all over the country and the world, indeed. What should someone keep in mind if they're going to attempt a letter to the editor to one of these big outfits?
Well, I think the same thing applies here. If you want to write a letter to the New York Times, first of all, pick up the New York Times op-ed page and see what letters to the editor look like, and then write in the same crisp style. If it is the Wall Street Journal, because the Wall Street Journal happens to be conservative, so therefore more entertaining, then try to be tongue-in-cheek if you can. It's always struck me that liberals don't have any sense of tongue-in-cheek, but conservatives tend to. So do that. But basically, I mean, the same rules apply here. The one thing you should not try to do, unless it's something really very egregious, is if you find something objectionable in them, say in the New York Times, and you then write to the Washington Post and said, since I know the New York Times is not going to print it, I hope you will. Well, that would only be the case if the New York Times had written an editorial, appealing for the assassination of somebody or, you know, Bush or something like that. Then obviously you would do something about that. But normally it doesn't work. There is still on that level a sense of collegiality and some sense of fairness. So if you have an argument with the New York Times, then argue in the New York Times against the New York Times. And if it's the Wall Street Journal, then write to the Wall Street Journal. Again, the chances of being reprinted are always remote. I mean, you know, even the best letters to the editor stand a very slim chance of being reprinted because you have so many writers.
What about longer form submissions? The average non-professional, but someone who is simply a reader, if he's going to go beyond the caliber of simply a letter to the editor and submit something to the editorial board that's longer, that's of a longer format.
Here's how I would go about that. I would perhaps write a brief letter to the editor at any rate, but then send an email to the letter to the editor's editor. to that op-ed editor and say, look, I am I was quite fascinated by your article here. I have a different point of view. In short, this is what I would like to do. Give me the space for an op-ed piece, and here are the reasons why I'm doing this, and here are my qualifications, you know. Briefly, just give them, ask them to invite you to write a longer piece, an op-ed piece, and then, for God's sake, if they say yes, then please stick to the lengths they give you. They say, well, you know, give us 600 words or 1,000 words or 800 words or whatever it is, then don't make it, then stick to that. And again, even in longer pieces, once you have agreed with the editor-in-chief or the editorial page editor that you will write this piece, it should again be written crisply, to the point, with a sense of humor, short sentences, grammatically correct, good punctuation, short paragraphs, and a good lead and a good kicker. Kicker meaning, you know, a good last punchline at the end.
Finally, Uwe, someone once said that the difference between propaganda and news is the editorial page, is that page where the readers get to respond. Talk about the need, especially for Christians living out their various vocations, to be involved in what's being printed in the news and be responsive readers to what's being printed in the news. You've got about a minute here.
Yeah, well, the reader exercises a vocation by informing himself or herself. And by engaging this world, as we all have to engage the world as Christians, so therefore the reader has to engage the daily newspaper to which he or she is a subscriber. Therefore, it is, I think, if the reader feels that his own faith is egregiously violated by something written in that newspaper or magazine, the reader should try to respond, but competently, not incompetently. That's the main thing.
Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. Who knows? If you read a letter to the editor next to something Uwe has written, it might be Uwe himself responding to himself. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the program, Pastor Mike Middendorf is going to be joining us. We're going to talk about the Word of God. He is at Concordia University in Irvine, California. We will be doing a sermon review tomorrow. Ken Hagee, a sermon on the marriage covenant. John Hagee, I'm sorry, on the marriage covenant. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.